You can start.
Thank you very much. And thanks a lot to Linda for the honor of being invited to come to such a beautiful city and to catch up with some old friends and for the opportunity to speak to you about taking genomics to hepatitis C practice. And thanks to all of you for coming back from the lunch break so you could listen. Now, we've already heard a good bit about IL-28 from several of the other speakers earlier this morning. And so there'll be a few points that I'll be going over for a second time, and I apologize a bit for that. But really the beginning, some of the first observations that were made that gave us a clue that there was a genetic basis to these clinical phenotypes were that, first of all, there were discrete outcomes that would occur with hepatitis C infection, whether it was recovery after initial infection that would happen in, let's say, 4 out of 10 individuals, or recovery after the administration of interferon. So discrete clinical outcomes that could not be explained by viral or environmental factors, and that differed according to race. Now, this may not be apparent in practicing in Italy, but in the United States, we were seeing very large differences in the likelihood of spontaneous resolution or treatment-related resolution in African Americans, persons from African descent, compared to Caucasians. And so collectively, these observations made us sure there had to be some genetic basis for these outcomes with hepatitis. So we spent, and these are just data to underscore the major difference, fivefold difference in spontaneous recovery between blacks and Caucasians in injection drug users in Baltimore. So this made us sure there was a genetic basis, and there have been many, many studies trying to find it. And the most important was this, and was done logically by comparing the DNA of individuals who recovered after treatment compared to those who received treatment and failed to get a sustained virologic response. And so this first study was done by the Goldstein group, and they didn't really have a very good idea which gene was going to explain this. So they did what's known as a genome-wide association study, where they took SNPs, more than 600,000 SNPs, representative of blocks of DNA all the way across the human genome, and studied their distribution in persons who had treatment-related clearance compared to those who failed to get an SVR. And when you compare the distribution of these SNPs in the two groups, you can see that for most of the SNPs, there's really the probability that there's a difference in the frequency of these SNPs is really not very high. So, and it's pretty much the same all the way along chromosome 1, 2, 3, nothing, 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 nothing. And then all of a sudden, out of 600,000 SNPs, you find seven SNPs that whose distribution is markedly different in persons who have respond to interferon compared to those who don't. And if you drill down and look in more detail, these SNPs all occur just in between the genes for IL-28B and IL-28A, and a little bit away from a third related gene, IL-29. These are the genes for the lambda interferons. The strongest associations actually occur just upstream, about 3 to 5 kilobases upstream from the initiation of the start codon for IL-28B. And this gene is oriented 3 to 5 in opposite direction from the gene for IL-28A, which goes that way. So, strong associations. One of the associations, it turns out, was in a coding region, a lysine to arginine mutation at position 70. But interestingly, this mutation was no stronger. This SNP that marked this association was not more tightly linked to the outcome than these others in the non-coding region. So if you look at the details of their study, this is the frequency of this SNP, the strongest SNP, which is a C or a T allele, approximately 3,000 bases upstream from the start of the IL-28B gene. If you look at the C allele, individuals who were homozygous for the C allele had an 81% chance of having a sustained virologic response, compared to those that had one of the T alleles, where the SVR rate was approximately 40%. If you break it down by race, you can see that this is true in African Americans, as well as in Hispanics and Caucasians. And notice also that the relative frequency of these alleles is different and explains about half of the racial differences in treatment-related recovery of hepatitis C. So if you look first at the Caucasians and sort of break these data down differently, you can see that the individuals with the CC allele, approximately 39% of all the Caucasians in this study had the CC allele, and about 82% of them went on and got the sustained virologic response. The CC allele individuals that were heterozygous or homozygous for the bad allele were much less likely to get a sustained virologic response. But one of the things that sometimes is missed is that still almost 40% of individuals with the unfavorable genotypes could achieve a sustained virologic response in this study, so that the positive predictive value here is very high in Caucasians, with 82% homozygous, 82% of the 40% that had this genotype being able to be cured. But the negative predictive value was not so high, and as many as 40% could still achieve a sustained virologic response even without the good phenotype. The same sorts of trends were seen in African Americans, and this is probably not as important to your practice here. Now, as was mentioned earlier today, the same association was found in similar studies from Japan and Australia, and collectively and from Switzerland, all in the same year. And so there's no question, it's actually one of the most robust findings in all of genetic medicine, there's absolutely no question about this linkage between these polymorphisms around the lambda interferon genes and treatment-related recovery from hepatitis C. Now, some people argue about one SNP versus another, and if you want, we can get into more of that in the question and answer period. But for all intents and purposes, there's in a Caucasian population, they're mapping the same thing. Now, if you look into a little bit more detail and ask the question, okay, we know that there's a difference in the sustained virologic responses, but how early in treatment can you see the difference by the genotype? So now we're looking at the very first days on pegylated interferon and ribavirin, and we're breaking down the reduction in HCV viral load according to the genotypes, with the CC being the homozygous favorable genotype that we just reviewed in the population studies. So notice that even in the first day or two, you can already see a marked difference in the reduction in the sensitivity of the tissue to interferon. Now, it's also been published since then, since its original discovery, that the same relationships exist for HIV co-infected individuals. So even in the HIV co-infected host, the polymorphisms around lambda interferon are strongly predictive of sustained virologic response. Now, it was asked earlier today, okay, well, this is fine, this very interesting finding, but we're really looking forward now to the use of these direct acting agents. And so the really pressing clinical question is, how do they predict response to the protease inhibitor, including pegylated interferon and ribavirin treatments? And so this is unfortunately the only, well, this is a good study, but unfortunately the only study we have is one. And this study from Japan is not very large, but it does give us a clue that the IL-28 polymorphisms are still predictive even in the era of direct-acting agents. Now, in addition, I'll point out that there's going to be more data in a couple weeks in Berlin, and you can so stay tuned or go online and look for the results of those, but we can't talk about those studies yet, I don't think. And so even in this Japanese study with the direct-acting agents, you can see that the individuals with the favorable genotype were more likely to get a sustained virologic response. Now, another interesting association or an interesting way of looking at this is to say, well, we don't really know the biology. We don't really know how this is working. So I wonder what happens when you take a liver out of one person and put it into another person. And I wonder if the donor's IL-28 status is important or the recipient's IL-28 status. Because as you know, of course, the donor is giving the liver, but the immune-fighting cells, all the T cells, the bone marrow-derived cells, are going to come from the recipient. And so there have been a couple of interesting studies published very recently where they've treated individuals who had a liver transplant, and then looked at the likelihood of responding according to whether their according to the IL-28 status of the donor and the recipient. So this is SVR percent, and then this is the when both the donor and the recipient have the unfavorable genetic block. This is when the donor has the good alleles and the recipient has had the bad alleles, and then the donor bad, recipient good, and then both good. And you can see that there seems to be an effect on both the donor and the liver IL-28 status. So I'm not sure that solved the pathophysiology for me, but I found that to be another interesting contribution. Now, some of you that really follow this field will also know that there have been recently that we found that the intrahepatic ISG state, the interferon-stimulated genes in the liver, are also strongly predictive of the response to interferon and ribavirin. And so they've tried to look at to what extent is it the IL-28 that matters, or is it the expression of ISGs within the liver. And so this is just the study from Duke where they've looked at the ISG state and then the according to the lambda genotypes. No, I'm sorry. Okay. And what you'll see is that there is greater expression of the interferon-stimulated genes in the persons with the unfavorable. So they have the individuals with the bad lambda genotypes that are not going to respond when you give them interferon have high expressions of interferon-stimulated genes like the ISG15 and the OAS. And these actually are probably part of the same causal pathway. That's something I was just talking to Mario about before the break, and something that we can go into in the question and answer session. So that's a bit of a clue to the pathophysiology of this relationship. Now, in addition to treatment-related response, it's also been evident that spontaneous resolution of hepatitis C is explained to a large extent by polymorphisms in lambda interferon. This is a study where a large number of individuals who either spontaneously resolve are compared to individuals with chronic hepatitis C. And you can see that there's a much greater proportion of individuals with spontaneous resolution have the CC, the favorable genetic background, and that's true in European Americans as well as African persons of African ancestry. And if you take a look at the distribution of this allele worldwide, and remember that the good allele is shown in green here, so this is the favorable allele, the C at this position, that this allele occurs much more often in Asia and in Europe than in Africa. And so the worldwide distribution of the allele also correlates with global differences in spontaneous resolution and in the likelihood of responding to interferon. So there's quite a bit of evidence now that both of these discrete outcomes that occur with hepatitis C are explained to a large measure by this association. Early on in the talk, I showed you a model where I was showing you that there was a five-fold increased risk of having persistent infection if you were African-American, or to say it differently, a five-fold risk of clearance if you're of European ancestry. So if you go back to that same model and add in the IL-28 genotype, you'll find that the association of about half of that racial difference is explained simply by this one SNP. And this one SNP becomes the dominant component of this model. So both with treatment-related and spontaneous resolution of hepatitis C, this lambda genotype explains about half of the clinical phenotype, which is really just pretty astonishing for a genetic marker like this. So what we know for sure, without any question, is that if you have a certain block of DNA right around in here, and if you in fact have just one of the unfavorable alleles, you're going to have both an increased risk of persistence and a harder time being treated. But what we don't know yet is why that is, and there's been quite a bit of speculation and various studies trying to explain why this small difference in DNA has such a huge impact on clinical outcomes. One interesting clue is that that same genetic polymorphism has absolutely no predictive value for other chronic viral infections, even those that affect the liver. So this study looks at the progression of HIV infection according to the lambda genotypes, and there's no association. In the same paper, the investigators looked at the likelihood of recovery from hepatitis B with lambda genotypes, and once again, no association has been found. So to date, it appears that these lambda polymorphisms only are dominant in explaining recovery from hepatitis C, either with treatment or spontaneous resolution. So how do you take all this information and put it into practice today and hopefully tomorrow? Well, I don't know if it's widely available here, but in the United States, starting in August, we had a test that was commercially available for IL-28 testing. And despite the fact that there really aren't any clear guidelines for its use, nor formal approval, the company's making quite a bit of money on this test. There's been a lot of this test being ordered. Somebody told me that there was more than 5,000 tests being ordered every month. So we have it, and a lot of people are getting it. So how do you use the information? Now, one thing that seems to me very logical is that you should use it for acute infection. And that's one of the places where I've already had the opportunity to use it. And to be clear, if you have someone who has the favorable, let's put it differently, if you have someone with the unfavorable genotype, you're going to want to treat that person's acute infection earlier and not wait until the person becomes interferon resistant when treatment will be much more difficult. In contrast, if they have the favorable genotype, you might give them a little bit longer, see if they spontaneously resolve, and know that even if you wait years later, you still have an 81, 82% chance of a sustained virologic response. What about the treatment of chronic infection? That's really where most of us are practicing. And there are, again, no clear guidelines, but a couple of ways in which you might think about using it. Certainly, this genetic test provides us the very important information about the likelihood of sustained virologic response. And so just as with genotype and viral load and other pretreatment factors that we have, you're going to use it to individualize your treatment decisions. It's possible that you might have an you might delay treatment in someone that has F0 or F1 with a bad bad pretreatment probability. In other words, they have one of the T alleles, because in that situation, you may not get a response to PEG and ribavirin, and you might be at risk of getting resistant mutations with the new direct-acting agent. So that might be a group of individuals where you use the information to delay and wait for new and better interferon-sparing treatments. And then finally, this test has certainly been used in clinical trials. And most of the clinical trials that involve interferon, if you have interferon as one of the arms of the study, you're going to have IL-28B testing and, in some instances, stratification to make sure that you understand differences in the strata. The type of treatment could also be different, although this is really becoming more speculative as I moved down the slide. Pegylated interferon and ribavirin without a protease inhibitor might be possible for a person with the favorable genotype. And remember, that could be 40% of Caucasians. So if you're not working with a lead-in strategy, you might be able to use the IL-28 testing, but we don't have this information yet to substantiate that use of the test. Likewise, it's possible that we may, it was already mentioned earlier that we're doing fewer and fewer biopsies. If you can use IL-28 testing and find out that somebody has an 80% chance of cure, you might be satisfied with just non-invasive testing to find out if you have cirrhosis and to tailor your HCC screening accordingly. And then these others are even more speculative indications. So there's a clear, strong, unquestionable, robust association with IL-28 and SVR. We still don't know the mechanism, but it's going to have applications in clinical practice. Now, in the same exact study, while they were comparing the DNAs to figure out the basis for interferon response, when they were done, they said, well, you know what? Some of our subjects got anemia and some didn't. I wonder if there's a genetic basis for that as well. And we've already done all the expensive work. Why not take a look and see if we find anything for the interferon-related anemia? And at least to my surprise, maybe not to everyone's, but to my surprise, again, looking at that same Manhattan plot, nothing, 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 nothing. And then all of a sudden, they had to get all the way to chromosome 20, and here we go. There's a couple of SNPs that strongly mark this development of anemia with the use of ribavirin. Now, it turns out that these are in the gene for inosine triphosphate, and a pair of these alleles are associated with ITPA deficiency, which in this case is beneficial. So if you look at the predicted decline in hemoglobin. So this is the development of anemia here. So you get a 3-gram reduction in your hemoglobin or drop your level below 10. You're much more likely to do that if you, you're much less likely to do that if you have these alleles that predict the ITP A deficiency, so they're protective for anemia. And that's true across the ethnic populations that existed in that study. Now, once again, I'm not going to, in the interest of time, go too much into the mechanism for that association, but it also remains speculative. And then I'll also observe that another SNP has been discovered that's been reported to have strong associations with SVR, with interferon ribavirin therapy. So right now, that test is not available. Is it available in Italy? No, it's not available in the United States. The ITPA is? Okay. So are you using it? Because I'll wait till the question and answer, because we don't have the test, so we don't have any indication. We don't have any guidelines for its use. But the obvious application would be to inform the use of ribavirin and maybe the dose. I think one of the exciting, both of these tests, the SNPs around lambda interferon and the SNPs around ITPA, are great indications of a promising future in genomic medicine and the ability to use genomic testing to understand and predict outcomes, both treatment-related outcomes as well as the adverse effects of the drugs. And so I think these are just the beginning of an exciting era where we'll be able to use genetic testing to explain a lot of what we've been unable to explain in medicine, and to be able to tailor treatments to patients and ultimately achieve much better therapeutic outcomes. And so these are a few of the areas where I think there's even immediate applications for this kind of genetic approach. So to conclude, I think that we're entering into an era of personalized medicine for hepatitis C. IL-28B clearly gives us important information on the likelihood of achieving a sustained virologic response. And I think that it sounds like you've already found ways to use the ITPA testing. I think we've also got a bright future. So thank you very much for your attention. And I'm sorry if I was a little bit slow, but my jet lag is...